Going live, guys. Going live in just a minute. Just had to share my link real quick. Oh, I didn't think about how my phone would fit in the stand with the mic plugged in. All right. Well, how's my sound? I'm not seeing my sound waves or sound bars or whatever it is. Shoot. How do I know if this is working? Yeah, I'm not seeing it. I see my microphone, but I'm not hearing it. How do I know if this is working? Good morning and welcome to the Rabbit Hole Power Hour, Episode 7. I'm your host, The Format. This is my station, Format FM. Station created by me, goes wherever I need to be. Today I got 5 stories for you, and I'm not going to waste a whole lot of time, so here we go. First up will be Ancient Civilizations and Pyramids on Antarctica. That's 7 to 8 minutes. After that, 10 shocking facts about the reptilian conspiracy from Listverse. That's 11 to 14 minutes. After that, Dark Rulers Are Trying to Suppress Our Ascension from Humans Are Free, and that's 4 to 5 minutes. Then another humansarefree.com selection. Next one is Death Is Not the End of Our Life Force Energy, 4 to 5 minutes. And then finally, What Did Jesus Really Say About Homosexuality? And that's a longer one, 18 to 23 minutes. So I'm having problems with my sound as usual. This is a work in progress. I'm not sure which version of this you'll hear. I have a couple backup recorders. But unfortunately, I'm going to have to just continue on. So let's get into our first story. From ancient-code.com, Ancient Civilizations and Pyramids on Antarctica. We all know that Antarctica was in the distant past a very different place. With its 14 million square kilometers, Antarctica is the 5th largest continent on our planet, and in other words, is twice the size of Australia. What we have to understand is that around 170 million years ago, Antarctica was part of the supercontinent called Gondwana. Around 25 million years ago, Antarctica as we know it gradually broke apart from Gondwana. According to research, Antarctica was not always cold, dry, and covered in ice sheets. Au contraire, during its long history, Antarctica was located farther north and experienced a tropical or temperate climate, meaning that it was covered in forests and inhabited by various ancient life forms. But what does this mean? Well, given the little we know about the life on our planet in the distant past, it is likely that people may have lived on this now icy continent and developed as a society just like people did in Africa, Europe, and Asia. What if there are really pyramids on Antarctica? According to creation.com, the Northern Hemisphere Arctic lands are well known for their warm climate, fossil plants and animals from the Mesozoic and early Cenozoic of the Uniformitarian Geological Column. I still find the idea that Antarctica was once forested absolutely mind-boggling. We take it for granted that Antarctica has always been a frozen wilderness, but the ice caps only appeared relatively recently in geological history, said Jane Francis of the University of Leeds to the BBC. People have speculated for a long time that Antarctica may have had civilized people calling it home. And if it did in the distant past, the ancient inhabitants of Antarctica must have left behind structures such as temples or even pyramids. Today, Antarctica is composed of around 98% ice, which is over a kilometer thick. So imagine if in the distant past, ancient people inhabited Antarctica when it was covered with vegetation and forests. All of their heritage is now buried under a thick layer of ice. Even though it is uninhabitable today and only scientists venture to Antarctica, in the distant past it might have been the perfect place for an ancient civilization to develop. Officially, it was in 1820 when a Russian expedition sighted a continental ice shelf and that Antarctica was discovered. But myths and speculation about Terra Australis date back to antiquity. Around 350 BC, Aristotle wrote in his book Meteorology about the Antarctic region. Marinus of Tyre, a Greek geographer, cartographer, and mathematician, used the name in a world map of the 2nd century AD. People believed in the distant past that a landmass called Terra Australis existed, a giant continent located in the southern parts of the planet, which was there to provide a balance for the northern lands of Europe, Asia, and North Africa. This idea existed since the times of Ptolemy, 1st century AD. Go back 100 million years ago and Antarctica was covered in lush rainforests similar to those that exist in New Zealand today. Coming from Dr. Vanessa Baumann, who works with Francis at the University of Leeds. Expeditions to Antarctica are extremely difficult and costly. Without the proper equipment, a human being wouldn't last very long on the icy continent. This makes it very difficult to search for proof of ancient structures in the southernmost continent on our planet. According to several websites, a group of European and American scientists came across pyramidal structures on Antarctica. According to an article at scienceray.com, the team composed of eight explorers found evidence of at least three man-made pyramids that were peaking through the melting ice on Antarctica. The author stated, "Can it be possible that Antarctica was once warm enough in the recent past to actually have had an ancient civilization living there?" And even more perplexing is the question of if an advanced culture did develop there, are there any structures still remaining that are buried underneath the ice? But what are these mysterious formations? Geologists who have taken the time to look at the images and data suggest that these pyramidal shapes are just natural formations. But what if there are pyramids hidden under the thick layers of ice on Antarctica? A discovery of that caliber would surely be shocking and change the way we look at our history forever. Since the discovery of the so-called pyramids on Antarctica, numerous theories have been proposed by UFOologists, ancient alien theorists, and researchers which try to explain what these structures are. While there are those who believe that Antarctica is home to many secret alien bases, others believe that the formations that were tagged as pyramids are nothing more than natural geological formations. But just wrap your mind around the idea that Antarctica was a green continent covered with vegetation in the past. We know very little about ancient history, and we come across something new that points to the fact that people have been on Earth far longer than we thought. What if an ancient civilization did in fact develop on Antarctica in the past? What if there are structures hidden beneath the thick layers of ice? What if an ancient civilization that is unknown to us did in fact develop on the continent we call Antarctica and built a thriving civilization that inhabited the continent up until weather conditions drastically changed. While these structures that are said to be man-made structures might turn out to be nothing but interesting geological formations, it is very likely that at some point, researchers will come across actual evidence of ancient man-made structures on the icy continent. Of course, for that to happen, a lot of ice would need to melt, and if all of Antarctica's ice were to melt, sea levels would rise about 60 meters, which would be catastrophic for some coastlines on our planet. Interestingly, according to researchers, the Antarctic Peninsula has warmed by an alarming 2.8 degrees Celsius, which is faster than any other part of the world. This means that if this warming were to continue unabated, it is very likely that in the future we could see a tropical Antarctica reappear. And that story comes from ancient-code.com. And as a typical tradition, after the first story, I got to take a quick break. This is a tobacco break for those of you who are smoking. Spark it up. Yeah, it is summertime. Oh, wow. It's my first breath of fresh air for the day. Apologies for the dead air. Moving right along. 10 shocking facts about the reptilian conspiracy, and this comes from listverse.com. Reptilians, lizard folk, sauroids. These are just some of the names associated with this alien race conspiracy. While some dismiss it as nonsense, a growing number of believers are eager to share their knowledge of reptilians living among us. These creatures disguise themselves as humans and often hold positions of power in the world's governments. Here are 10 disturbing facts about the reptilian conspiracy that you may not know. Number 10. Reptilians are on Time Magazine's top 10 most enduring conspiracy theories. In July 2009, the Time list included details about reptilians' appetites for human flesh, their responsibility for numerous terrorist attacks, and their ultimate desire to enslave the human race. Also mentioned are a few high-ranking politicians believed to be reptilians. For the uninitiated, there's an introduction to author David Icke, the poster human for the reptilian conspiracy. His books on the subject have undoubtedly helped the reptilian conspiracy grab the attention of such a mainstream publication. Much more about the reptilian conspiracy has been published over the years, notably in Icke's numerous books, such as The Biggest Secret and Children of the Matrix. Number 9. David Icke used to refuse to wear any color other than turquoise. On a trip to ancient Incan ruins in 1991, Icke experienced an intense spiritual experience that he described as a complete change in his state of consciousness. He described a state of intense, pure energy and claimed to hear voices that whispered hidden truths. He emerged, convinced that he was the new incarnation of Jesus Christ, and his insistence on wearing only the color turquoise came from his belief that it would allow the continuous flow of positive energy through him. He could then channel that energy more easily toward researching the extent of the reptilians' rule over the world. Number 8. You could be half reptilian and not even know it. Or you could at least be part of the reptilian bloodline. Reptilians have been crossbreeding with select, unsuspecting humans for millennia to create desired elite bloodlines that they can use to covertly control the world. DNA from reptilians has passed down through generations, and some crossbreeds even begin life as full-blood humans. At later points in their lives, they're taken away to have reptilian DNA mixed with their own. They're returned to their normal lives with no memory of it. Diehard reptilian believers offer this as the real explanation behind UFO abductions and strange disappearances in which the person returns unable to recall what happened. Some signs that a person may be a reptilian-human crossbreed include a high level of personal charisma, pronounced artistic talent, and intense, vivid colored eyes. The most common eye colors among them are hazel and green, though sometimes bright blue as well. Some have eye colors that seem to change in different lighting, as well as low blood pressure. Human-reptilian hybrids have distinct personality traits as well, such as a deep sense of caring about the state of the world. Those who have been taken and changed into reptilian crossbreeds often feel a profound sense of separation that they no longer completely belong to the human race. As widely reported in alien abduction cases, many of them have unexplained and odd scars on their bodies. Number 7. Reptilians only let us humans think we're in charge. The master race of full-blood reptilians has been on Earth since ancient Babylonian times. Their original species was called Anunnaki, and they inhabit underground cities below the Earth's surface. Through both their telepathic abilities and energies drawn from the moon, they're able to create the intricate holographs we humans interpret as our reality. Through mind control, the Anunnaki have always given the human race our sense of freedom and power. David Icke has also reported in detail about how the reptilians spread their bloodline throughout the royal families, owners of the world's banks, and heads of the biggest worldwide corporations. Interbreeding among the royals and unions only between certain families have kept the reptilian bloodline strong ever since the days of ancient Babylon. Number 6. Reptilians came from both other planets and other dimensions. Anunnaki reptilians traveled to Earth from the solar system surrounding the stars Draco and Zeta Reticuli. They're also capable of travel between different dimensions of time and space. This allows them even further control over the false realities they want us unwitting humans to accept as our day-to-day truth. When the first reptilian master race colonized Earth, they already had the technology to create hybrid offspring with humans through direct manipulation and fusion of DNA. Number 5. Reptilians feed on negative human energy. Along with their fondness for drinking human blood and cannibalistic ritual sacrifice, reptilians also hunger for negative emotional energy. To draw on it, they strive to keep the human race in a collective state of fear and uncertainty. We only need to look at world events that we believe are the causes, such as natural disasters, political instability, and threats of war, just for a few examples. These are examples of the reality the reptilians want us to believe. The world's leaders, who are shape-shifting reptilians, only fuel this fear with the messages they convey to the public. Uncertainty and fear make the human population much easier to control. Most will latch onto whatever their leaders say is the answer. The subterranean reptilian population is able to orchestrate any natural disaster when they feel the need to ratchet up human fear, including hurricanes, tornadoes, and tsunamis. The full-blooded Anunnaki reptilians are also believed to be responsible for setting major terrorist attacks in motion, 9/11 being only one example. When full-blooded members of the reptilian master race shift into their human form and spend time on the Earth's surface, humans with reptilian DNA in their blood are sometimes able to sense the full-blood reptilians' true identities when they encounter them. Those who have reptilian blood may feel fearful or uneasy for no apparent reason when they have any contact with a member of the master race. True believers in this conspiracy predict that the reptilians will eventually spend more time among us and keep occupying more positions of power until the human race bends completely to their control. This physical and mental control of the human population will only be strengthened as the reptilians continue to create hybrids to spread the Anunnaki bloodline further across the globe. Number four, reptilians can use stronger mind control on humans who have reptilian DNA. If you think reptilian DNA will give you cool superpowers, think again. If you have it, you're most likely doomed to enslavement by the full-blooded master race. The only reason you were either born or engineered as a crossbreed is to further those plans. The more reptilian DNA in your blood, the easier it is for them to make telepathic connections with your mind without your conscious knowledge. High-ranking national leaders and corporate executives are some of the likeliest suspects to have reptilian DNA in their blood. Whether you were born with reptilian DNA or were taken away to have your human DNA fused with it, you may start feeling a sense of isolation from the rest of the human race. Those who belong to the reptilian bloodline often feel a profound sense of concern for the ultimate fate of the planet, which is completely understandable given the plans of the full-blooded reptilian race. Number three, reptilians are the real founders of every secret society. Exclusive secret societies such as the Illuminati have been subjects of mystery for centuries. The lore created about them is made up to disguise the fact that all of them originate within the reptilians. Gatherings of members have long been reported to include rituals of blood drinking, sex orgies, cannibalism, and even sacrifices of animals or children in exchange for more illusions of power that only the master reptilian race can give. Probably the most notorious of these secret ritual meetings takes place every summer at Bohemian Grove in Northern California. The rites of blood sacrifice are reportedly to satisfy reptilian appetites that are understandably kept hidden from the public eye. The exclusive club of the same name can be joined by an invitation only, and even guests at the Bohemian Grove camp must go through a strict screening process. Members include high-ranking Wall Street bankers, corporate CEOs, and former U.S. presidents. Security is very tight around ceremonies and rituals taking place at Bohemian Grove, leaving outsiders with much reason for curiosity and suspicion. A brave few people have attempted to sneak out hidden videos of these secret rituals, but the poor quality of the footage has raised more questions than answers. The conspiracy theories surrounding Bohemian Grove deserve a list all of their own. Number two, reptilians shapeshift into any human form. Not always staying in their subterranean cities, reptilians easily assume the form of humans to further infiltrate and influence the state of our world. Whether only full-blood reptilians can shapeshift is open to debate among conspiracy believers. Some report that crossbreeds are also capable of it. Reptilian conspiracy theories have also posted countless videos of supposed slips in a reptilian's human disguise that is caught on camera. Many of these clips are of popular celebrities, which leads skeptics to easily dismiss them as mere dislike or disapproval of the celebrity on the part of the conspiracy theorists. Other reptilian believers don't like or approve of these slips of disguise videos because they believe this material gives the reptilian conspiracy less credibility. A few have voiced that posting these videos makes reptilian believers as a whole look ridiculous. To a neutral viewer, these slips simply appear as shifts in the lighting, abrupt changes in facial expressions, or other mundane occurrences. Number one, knowledge of the reptilians will be their defeat. David Icke writes in several books that reptilians' ultimate goal is to enslave the human race physically and mentally. Despite their powers, reptilians aren't invincible. The more knowledge we humans have, the better we'll be able to recognize signs of them among us and see the truth behind the false reality. When the reptilians are defeated in a distant future, the human race will rise to a higher level of spiritual consciousness. Icke draws from several aspects of New Age philosophy to make oneself more receptive to this knowledge. His longtime practices have included balancing of the body's chakras, the drawing on crystal energies, and the drinking of hallucinogenic ayahuasca. Despite being the object of ridicule from the mainstream media and even from other conspiracy theorists, David Icke maintains a loyal and growing following to this day. All right, give me just a second. I got to move a couple things around. Just a minute. Sorry about that. Had to move my mic. Sorry that most podcasts have commercials and I just have awkward silences and screwing around with microphones. It's a work in progress. You guys, if you're listening, you should see the ridiculous setup I have over here. Okay, finally moving on. Next story. Dark rulers are trying to suppress our ascension. From humansarefree.com, written by Terry Wade. Humanity has been sought after our entire existence due to a little thing called human DNA. Our DNA has been damaged, and we have been dumbed down to the point that we've never known how incredible we really are. Our DNA is being activated, meaning those two biological strands of DNA are starting to talk to those 10 strands of DNA that spiral and intertwine up through them. Those 10 strands of DNA have been intentionally cut from us because those 10 strands are our interdimensional strands. They cut these strands so they couldn't talk to the two biological strands. They couldn't communicate, so it kept us in a very low vibrational existence. It's keeping us isolated from an incredible reality. Meaning, our DNA is made up of 12 strands, and there's one strand for each dimension, and that certain strand corresponds to that density of experience. It's the experiences of these higher frequency densities is what continues our evolution, and this is what they're trying to keep us from. That reality is where all of our psychic abilities are. Telepathy, healing abilities, time travel, that's where your entire Akashic records are held, and much, much more. This dark enemy is trying to erase the original blueprint of the human DNA that we are clawing our way back up to achieve, bringing us back to our original blueprint as at the time of our creation. These dark rulers are trying to suppress our ascension. We need to look at the great lengths these psychopaths go to downgrade our DNA, meaning they've tried to suppress our ascension with chemicals, toxins, poisons, vaccinations, GMO foods. They bombard us with low-frequency signals to keep us in control. Currently, They are in a massive push for physical, global control because they cannot stop what's coming due to this incredible human awakening. It is a true testament to our incredible power, the draconian lengths these dirty players have to go to. These elite off-world psychopaths live in extreme fear of humanity waking up and expanding our awareness because they lose everything, meaning total control of their entire empire. The enemy's plan is to erase every bit of our original coding to accomplish complete control over the human race. I've said this before, I believe that's what's happened to the Greys. Meaning, back in the 80s, there was a major phase of abductions of humanity by the Greys because they were becoming completely artificially intelligent. They were losing all power of individual thought and needed our DNA to bring that back, but to no avail. They too were victims of this reptilian element. They are and have been a dying race. These dark players' goal is to hybridize the human race, to be a race of corrupt, non-empathetic AI with no individual thought process and emotion. Because with emotion we ask questions, so in turn we want answers, which is a major threat to them. They want us to be a corrupt, artificial bloodline, so we're easier to control. They are trying to suppress our frequency, and to do that biologically, they do that through poisons, toxic vaccinations, poisonous food, etc. To do this consciously, they do this through frequency bombardment of low vibrational signals. People that are not mentally stable to begin with are easily corrupted by these signals. Meaning if they're able to step off the edge, these signals and frequencies will push them, and they will lose their minds. These dark rulers know boundaries and restrictions limit our spiritual growth, because not only does our DNA exist biologically, but dimensionally as well. They've been trying to destroy us biologically, and at the same time, destroying us consciously. But that's not going to happen. These elite psychopaths know they're about to lose their mighty empire, and they're not about to let it go without a fight. Hence, the current global situation. It's going to get rough, real rough, but humanity has no other option but to fight. Dark to light. And that was written by Terry Wade, and that's from humansarefree.com. Another one from Humans Are Free. This is called Death Is Not the End of Our Life Force Energy. Most people will experience some form of grief in their life due to loss. It is helpful to remember that grieving is a process, not a permanent condition. Grief is the energetic and emotional withdrawal that occurs when the vibration and resonance of a person who is no longer here is removed from the third dimensional reality of another person. When the person departs, those who are close to them experience major energetic shifts as a result of the permanent separation. Death is not the end, reincarnation. This process is a universal one, although in other cultures, grief is sometimes approached differently. In some societies, after a person dies, there's dancing, storytelling, and music. The night of partying is designed to drive away grief, and for that night, at least, it works. However, for the most part, people tend to hold on to feelings, many times in an attempt to hold on to the person. Once the process of dying begins, the energy of the person begins to transform. As life force energy is transformed to its next destination, they become less alive in the third dimension. Some people leave suddenly and others take longer, but it is all by design. There are certain times when it is auspicious for a person to be born, and the same goes for dying. The person's subconscious and their higher self will create whatever circumstances are necessary to achieve this departure. How they leave can be likened to how some people enter the ocean to swim. Some run and jump in, others wade in, gradually getting used to the water. It is presumed that when a person dies, that it is the physical condition that is responsible, but it's actually the reverse. The life force energy of the person leaves the body first, and then the body, which cannot continue without it, expires. Long-term illness is the result of the body reacting to the essence of the person, slowly leaving the physical form. Sudden death happens when the life force energy leaves very quickly. When one is ill and it is not the time for them to go, life force energy returns and the person recovers. If it is time to leave this incarnation, there is no physical recovery. Dying is similar to being born. Some births are easy and some very difficult. While experiencing the grieving process, remember that the universe is perfectly on time. This includes the moment a person is born and when they pass away. No one leaves before his or her time. Therefore, death should not be looked upon as something unnatural or untimely. Yes, of course, a person will be missed, but their leaving is not a cosmic mistake. Agreements are made before a person incarnates, and dying is part of that agreement. It doesn't help to make part of someone's life a tragedy. What truly matters is that the essence of any person does not die. Instead, incarnations are completed, and the soul, higher self, spirit, or whatever you wish to call it, can move on. This is not just an exercise in semantics. Nothing really does die, because everything is made up of energy which cannot be destroyed, only transformed and transmuted into something else. Loved ones remain, not just in memories, but also in reality, just not the third-dimensional reality. Therefore, it is time to take another view of the processes of life. Someday dying might even be a very unusual occurrence. In modern cultures, many people are physically removed from extended families and communities in which births and deaths are experienced firsthand. Because of this, they are not accustomed to death as part of the cycle of life. Death is not a tragedy, but an occasion to celebrate the life of a person and revere the process of the transition. They will be missed, sometimes terribly, but on the other hand, they can be remembered. In other dimensions, they are still together with those who love them. The love that is shared with those that have gone is real, and that love endures eternally. If a person's death is truly the successful conclusion of a contract, which they agreed to before being born, then it can be viewed as a perfectly completed project. From that standpoint, everyone's life, no matter how long or short, was as it should be. By Wendy Ann Zalia from Gaia.com. Go check out the Gaia community, check out their library, films, and documentaries over at Gaia.com. All right. One more story for today. One more. Before I get into this, let me have a little bit more tobacco. This recording is the first time I've sat down all day. Some of the people in the chat are asking about the tobacco. This is apple cherrywood flavored tobacco. It's very nice. All natural. All right, final story. What did Jesus really say about homosexuality? From talesoftimesforgotten.com. None of the canonical gospels portray Jesus as having said anything whatsoever about homosexuality. You can scour every last line of the four canonical gospels and you won't find anything that can be unambiguously interpreted as a reference to homosexuality in any form. As far as the Gospels are concerned, Jesus did not condemn homosexuality, but he did not endorse it either. Fascinatingly, though, it is possible that there may have been an alternate, non-canonical version of the Gospel of Mark in circulation in the 2nd century CE that implied that Jesus himself had sexual relations with men. The existence of this possible version of the Gospel of Mark is controversial, and many scholars regard it as a flat-out hoax. Nonetheless, it is worth talking about, even if only for the sake of curiosity. A brief disclaimer. First, it is important to note that people in the ancient Mediterranean generally did not tend to think about sexual orientation in the same way that people in the United States in the 21st century tend to think about it. Generally speaking, people in the ancient Mediterranean world did not have the concept that people are inherently gay or inherently straight. People thought about sexuality more in terms of action, not orientation or identity. If a man in the ancient Mediterranean had sexual relations with other men, then people did not generally think of him as an inherently gay man. Instead, they simply saw him as a man who had sexual relations with other men. The idea that people are inherently gay or inherently straight does appear in a few ancient texts. For instance, Plato's Symposium, 189 to 193. But this idea didn't really become the dominant way of thinking about sexuality until the 19th century CE. Jesus' dispute with the Pharisees over divorce. Now let's talk about what the canonical Gospels portray Jesus as saying about homosexual activity, or more accurately, what they don't portray him as saying. Many people have tried to interpret various passages from the Gospel as either condemning or endorsing homosexuality. But upon closer examination, it can easily be shown that none of these passages really have anything to do with homosexuality. For instance, people who want to believe that Jesus disapproved of homosexuality often point to a story about a supposed interaction between Jesus and a group of Pharisees that is first attested in the Gospel of Mark. Here is the passage in question, translated in the New Revised Standard Version. Some Pharisees came, and to test him they asked, "Is it lawful for a man to divorce his wife?" He answered them, "What did Moses command you?" They said, "Moses allowed a man to write a certificate of dismissal and to divorce her." But Jesus said to them, "Because of your hardness of heart, he wrote this commandment for you. But from the beginning of creation, God made them male and female. For this reason, a man shall leave his father and mother to be joined to his wife, and the two shall become one flesh. So they are no longer two, but one flesh. Therefore, what God has joined together, let no one separate." Many people have tried to claim that Jesus' reply to the Pharisees in this passage is his definition of which kinds of sexual relationships are lawful, and that this definition strictly excludes all forms of homosexuality. This argument, however, is easily disproven by the context of the passage. In this passage, Jesus is clearly not trying to give a comprehensive definition of which kinds of sexual relationships are lawful. He is merely trying to answer a specific question that the Pharisees have asked him about whether it is lawful for a man to divorce his wife. Anyone who tries to interpret this passage as a condemnation of homosexuality is clearly overinterpreting. Jesus and the centurion. Meanwhile, many people who want to believe that Jesus approved of homosexuality point to a story that is attested in the Gospel of Matthew and the Gospel of Luke. In the story, a centurion comes to Jesus and tells him that his, I don't know what this word is, pais or pais, P-A-I-S, which means slave boy, is very ill, and he asks Jesus to cure him. Jesus accordingly does so. Here's the version of the story from the Gospel of Matthew in the New Revised Standard Version, with some minor modifications to bring it closer to the Greek. When he entered Capernaum, a centurion came to him, appealing to him and saying, "Lord, my slave boy is lying at home paralyzed in terrible distress." And he said to him, "I will come and cure him." The centurion answered, "Lord, I am not worthy to have you come under my roof, but only speak the word, and my servant will be healed. For I also am a man under authority, with soldiers under me, and I say to one, 'Go,' and he goes, and to another, 'Come,' and he comes, and to my slave, 'Do this,' and the slave does it." When Jesus heard him, he was amazed, and said to those who followed him, "Truly I tell you, in no one in Israel have I found such faith. I tell you, many will come from east and west and will eat with Abraham and Isaac and Jacob in the kingdom of heaven, while the heirs of the kingdom will be thrown into the outer darkness, where there will be weeping and gnashing of teeth." And to the centurion, Jesus said, "Go, let it be done for you according to your faith." And the slave boy was healed in that hour. Many people have tried to argue that the Greek word for pious, pace, or however it's said, is used in this passage actually means catamite, a male slave kept by a master to be used for sexual purposes. They argue that by agreeing to heal the slave boy, Jesus was giving implicit sanction to the centurion's relationship with him and thereby approving gay relationships in general. As someone who could actually read Greek, I can say that this argument fails on several levels. First of all, in Greek, the pais or pais is the most common word that means boy or slave boy. It's true that this word might be used in some context to refer to a catamite, but the word doesn't necessarily mean catamite. The word is very commonly used in Koine Greek texts without any kind of sexual implication, and there is nothing in the story about Jesus and the centurion to independently suggest that the Gospels are using the word with a sexual connotation. With a sexual connotation. The only reason why some people interpret the pais in this passage as a catamite is because they want him to be a catamite. Furthermore, even the pais in this passage were indeed supposed to be a catamite. The argument that Jesus approved of the centurion's relationship with his slave boy hinges on the crucial assumption that Jesus understood that the slave boy was the centurion's catamite. But there's also nothing in this passage to suggest that Jesus believed this about the slave boy. Finally, this whole argument is really wrongheaded in my view. If we assume that the pais in the story is indeed a catamite, then this isn't really the kind of relationship that we should be glorifying. We are hypothetically talking about a powerful adult Roman centurion forcing an enslaved adolescent boy to provide him with sexual favors. This is clearly not a healthy, consensual gay relationship in any sense. If you argue that Jesus approved of Roman centurions keeping teenage boys as sex slaves for their own exploitation, that's really more of an argument that Jesus was a terrible person than an argument that Jesus approved of gay relationships. Eunuchs from birth. Other people who want to argue that Jesus approved of homosexuality have tried to point to a passage found in the Gospel of Matthew in which Jesus declares, translated in the New Revised Standard Version, "For there are eunuchs who have been so from birth, and there are eunuchs who have been made eunuchs by others. And there are eunuchs who have made themselves eunuchs for the sake of the kingdom of heaven." Let anyone accept this who can. Many people have tried to interpret the phrase eunuchs who have been so from birth as a reference to homosexuality. This is, however, almost certainly not the case. Gay people are not eunuchs, nor would a person in the ancient world have been likely to conflate a gay person with a eunuch. As I discuss in this article from August 2020, the phrase eunuchs who have been so from birth in this passage almost certainly refers to people who are literally born with intersex genitalia. Intersex people were well known in the ancient world, and they were widely referred to as eunuchs. For instance, the famous Gallo-Roman orator Favorinus of Arelet, who lived 80 to 160 CE, is described in contemporary sources as a eunuch born without testicles, rather than castrated. The reference in this passage to eunuchs who have been so from birth definitely proves that the author of the Gospel of Matthew was aware of the existence of people who were born with non-conformative genitalia. It does not, however, prove that Jesus openly approved of homosexuality. The bottom line here is that there is nothing in any of the canonical Gospels to suggest that Jesus ever talked about homosexuality, or that he was even necessarily aware of its existence. As far as the canonical Gospels are concerned, Jesus simply never talked about it. If you want to find any kind of content about Jesus and homosexuality, you're going to have to turn to non-canonical source material. A very strange passage. Before I talk about possible non-canonical source that may imply that Jesus engaged in sexual relations with men, allow me to talk about a very strange passage that occurs in the canonical Gospel of Mark. Right before the passage, the Gospel describes how the Romans arrested Jesus and how all Jesus' disciples fled in terror. Then, for some reason, the Gospel writer decides to tell us this. And this is, of course, the New Revised Standard Version. A certain young man was following him, wearing nothing but a linen cloth. They caught hold of him, but he left the linen cloth and ran off naked. Scholars have puzzled over this passage for centuries. It seems entirely out of place. Jesus had just been arrested. All the disciples have run away. And then suddenly, for no apparent reason, the Gospel decides to tell us about a random naked man running away. The Gospel never tells us anything about who this man is, why he's there, why he's naked, or why the Romans are chasing him. Well, nearly six decades ago, a scholar claimed to have made a discovery that might provide an answer. A supposed long-lost ancient letter. In summer 1958, Morton Smith, a professor of ancient history from Columbia University, visited ancient Greek Orthodox Mar Saba Monastery, located near Jerusalem. According to his own account, while he was there, he discovered an 18th century handwritten transcription of a previously unknown letter attributed to the church father Clement of Alexandria, who lived from 150 to 215 CE. Scrawled in the end papers of a 1649 printed edition of the work of the church father Ignatius of Antioch. This letter that Smith supposedly discovered at Mar Saba describes two alternate versions of the Gospel of Mark that were supposedly in circulation at the time when Clement of Alexandria was alive. The letter states that there was a version of the Gospel of Mark known as the Secret Gospel of Mark, which supposedly included a very interesting passage between the verses that are now labeled Mark 10:34 and 10:35. The passage reads as follows, as translated by Morton Smith. And they come into Bethany, and a certain woman whose brother had died was there. And coming, she prostrated herself before Jesus and says to him, Son of David, have mercy on me. But the disciples rebuked her, and Jesus, being angered, went off with her into the garden, where the tomb was, and straightway a great cry was heard from the tomb. And going near, Jesus rolled away the stone from the door of the tomb, and straightway going in where the youth was, he stretched forth his hand and raised him, seizing his hand. But the youth, looking upon him, loved him and began to beseech him that he might be with him. And going out of the tomb, they came into the house of the youth, for he was rich. And after 6 days, Jesus told him what to do, and in the evening the youth comes to him, wearing a linen cloth over his naked body. And he remained with him that night, for Jesus taught him the mystery of the kingdom of God. And thence, arising, he returned to the other side of the Jordan. The Marsaba letter asserts that this version of the Gospel of Mark was written by Mark the Evangelist himself as a more mystical version of the Gospel. If this is true, it is impossible to resist the conclusion that the young man who is described as spending the night with Jesus, wearing only a linen cloth over his naked body, is in fact the same youth wearing the linen cloth who is mentioned as fleeing from the scene of Jesus' arrest in Mark 14:51 and 52, and that in the Gospel this young man is possibly Jesus' lover. But things get even stranger. The Marsaba letter also mentions that the Carpocratians, a group of libertine Gnostic Christians, whom proto-Orthodox Christians like Clement regarded as heretics, apparently used a different version of the secret Gospel of Mark that included the phrases... Sorry, that's in Greek. I can't read it at all. A phrase that means naked man with naked man. The Marsaba letter, however, insists that this phrase was inserted by the Carpocratians to justify their sexual misdeeds, and that it was not a part of the true secret gospel. Morton Smith took a set of photographs of the Marsaba letter in black and white. He spent the next 15 years of his life preparing a major academic book on the subject, titled Clement of Alexandria and a Secret Gospel of Mark, which was published by Harvard University Press in 1973. He followed this book up with a book aimed at popular audiences titled The Secret Gospel, The Discovery and Interpretation of the Secret Gospel According to Mark, which was published by Harper and Row. Unsurprisingly, as soon as Smith's first book about the secret gospel of Mark was published, it immediately provoked widespread controversy. Many scholars immediately began to argue that Morton Smith did not really find the letter at Marsaba as he claimed, but rather used his extensive expert knowledge of the Greek language and early Christian history to fabricate the whole thing himself as a cunning literary forgery. In 1976, the professors David Flusser and Shlomo Pines, Archimandrite Meliton of the Greek Orthodox of Jerusalem, and a young graduate student named Guy Stromsa, visited the Marsaba Monastery and saw the Marsaba letter, confirming for themselves that the letter existed. In around 1977, Callistos Dorvas, the librarian of the Marsaba Monastery, removed the pages containing the text of the Marsaba letter from the volume containing the works of Ignatius of Antioch, so that the pages could be stored and cataloged separately. In 1983, Dorvas took a set of color photographs of the pages in question. After that, the letter was lost. Today, no one has any idea where the Marsaba letter is. The two sets of photographs taken of the letter by Smith himself and by Callistos Dorvas are now the only proof that the letter ever existed at all. The letter was lost so many decades ago that nearly every person who is known to have seen it is now dead. Morton Smith himself died in 1991. Guy Stromsa is the only living Western scholar who is known to have seen the Marsaba letter in person. He saw the letter as a young graduate student way back in 1976. He is now a 72-year-old emeritus professor. The question of authenticity. There are multiple levels of questions about the Marsaba letter's authenticity. First, there is the question of whether the Marsaba letter itself is authentic, in the sense of it having actually been written by Clement of Alexandria. Scholars' opinion about the authenticity of the Marsaba letter remain divided. Many scholars have posed quite reasoned arguments that Morton Smith completely forged the letter himself. Meanwhile, other scholars continue to defend the letter's authenticity. I'm not really qualified to make an assessment here. If Smith did not forge the letter, then the letter almost certainly must have really been written by Clement of Alexandria, since the language used in the letter is so characteristically similar to Clement's other writings that modern scholars generally agree that it is impossible that anyone other than an extremely adept scholar with access to modern critical resources could have forged it. If the letter was really written by Clement, however, this raises the further questions of whether Clement's information was correct. Was the secret Gospel of Mark that it described in the letter actually written by the same author as the Gospel of Mark that has been passed down through the medieval manuscript tradition? Is our version of the Gospel actually bolderized version? Or is it the other way around? Perhaps our version of the Gospel of Mark is in fact the original, and the secret Gospel of Mark is a later version created by an author with mystical inclinations. For that matter, what about the other version of the Gospel mentioned in the Marsaba letter? The one used by the Carpocratians that supposedly included the phrase, which means slave boy. Was this phrase really a spurious insert, as the letter claims? Or was it perhaps included in the original version of the Gospel and only edited out by a later bolderizer? Again, I don't think I'm really qualified to answer these questions. My inclination is that the Marsaba letter is most likely a forgery. Even if the letter is authentic, I don't think it provides compelling evidence that the historical Jesus had sex with men. It is, however, interesting to note the possibility that some Christians in antiquity may have thought that Jesus had sex with men. And this is written by Spencer Alexander McDaniel, and it comes to you from talesoftimesforgotten.com. And that is the last story that I have today. But I think I have a little bit of time left. All right, I'm going to do one more thing before I sign out. Just because I have this sitting on my desk right now. As I record today, it's September 19th, 2022. This is a recent article. It comes from CAPoliticalReview.com. Ethically unjustifiable. Scientists from Harvard and Johns Hopkins found COVID-19 vaccines 98 times worse than the virus. From California Political Review, written by Stephen Frank. We knew it. Fauci and his accomplices lied to us. A new preprint study by 9 health experts from major universities showed that the COVID-19 vaccines are 98 times worse than the virus, and mandatory booster vaccination in college is ethically unjustifiable, as reported by the Epoch Times. The study was posted on the Social Science Research Network, SSRN, in September. titled COVID-19 Vaccine Boosters for Young Adults, a Risk-Benefit Assessment, and 5 Ethical Arguments Against Mandates at Universities. They knew masks were worthless, but shamed people into wearing them. They knew social distancing was a hoax, but they wanted to control us. Now we find out why the CDC, after tens of thousands of deaths of people who have taken the vaccine, have died, and the agency refuses to release all of the numbers. This is fraud by the government and the drug companies. The new booster that is coming out this week was never tested on humans. Take it at your own risk. The study was conducted by 9 top scientists from the University of Washington, the University of Oxford, the University of Toronto, Harvard University, Harvard Medical School, University of California, San Francisco, Johns Hopkins University, Department of Surgery, and others. Using CDC and sponsor-reported adverse event data, researchers conclude that booster regulations may result in more harm than good. According to the study, for every 1 COVID hospitalization prevented in previously uninfected young adults, 18 to 98 actual serious adverse events have been caused. Per COVID-19 hospitalization prevented in previously uninfected young adults, we anticipate 18 to 98 serious adverse events, including 1.7 to 3 booster-associated myocarditis cases in males, and 1,373 to 3,234 cases of grade 3 and above reactogenicity, which interferes with daily activities. University booster mandates were deemed unethical by the researchers for the following reasons. No formal risk-benefit assessment exists for this age group. Vaccine mandates may result in a net expected harm to individual young people. Mandates are not proportionate. Expected harms are not outweighed by public health benefits, given the modest and transient effectiveness of vaccines against transmission. U.S. mandates violate the reciprocity principle because rare serious vaccine-related harms will not be reliably compensated due to gaps in current vaccine injury schemes, and mandates create wider social harms. We consider counter-arguments, such as a desire for socialization and safety, and show that such arguments lack scientific and/or ethical support. The study concludes, based on public data provided by the CDC, we estimate that approximately 22,000 to 30,000 previously uninfected young adults ages 18 to 29 must be boosted with an mRNA vaccine to prevent 1 COVID-19 hospitalization. Given the fact that this estimate does not take into account the protection conferred by prior infection nor a risk adjustment for comorbidity status, this should be considered a conservative and optimistic assessment of benefit. Our estimate shows that university COVID-19 vaccine mandates are likely to cause net expected harms to young healthy adults between 18 and 98 serious adverse events requiring hospitalization and 1,373 to 3,234 disruptions of daily activities. That is not outweighed by proportionate public health benefit. Serious COVID-19 vaccine-associated harms are not adequately compensated for by current U.S. vaccine injury systems, and as such, these severe infringements of individual liberty are ethically unjustifiable. Worse still, mandates are associated with wider social harms. The fact that such policies were implemented despite controversy among experts and without updating the sole publicly available risk-benefit analysis to the current Omicron variants suggests a profound lack of transparency in scientific and regulatory policy making. These findings have implications for mandates in other settings such as schools, corporations, healthcare systems, and the military. Policymakers should repeal booster mandates for young adults immediately ensure pathways to compensation to those who have suffered negative consequences from these policies, provide open access to participant-level clinical trial data to allow risk and age-stratified harm-benefit analyses of any new vaccines prior to issuing recommendations, and begin what will be a long process of rebuilding trust in public health. Well, what do you think about that? That was just something I had I wanted to share. But I think my hour is up, so I want to thank everyone who has joined me again. I think the seventh hour was a success, so I'm going to get out of here while I'm ahead. Catch me next time. Talk to you later, and have a great day. Okay. The only place I'm still live is Podbeam. Is anyone on there? Oh, yeah, we got some people. I wanted to give a couple quick shout outs. Let me just find them. Maybe I can't. Oh, yeah, there we go. Big Chief Thunderlungs, my follower, thanks for joining. Shout out to Raccoon 6, thanks for coming along. I think I'm going to take off because I don't have anything else printed out here to read to you. So thanks for joining me. Talk to you guys later. Have a good one.